Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Americans are spending more than ever online. Last year, the average U.S. family spent $5,200 online. That's an increase of about $2,000 since 2013. Big online spending is good for retailers, but not so much for the brick-and-mortar stores. This year, more than 7,000 retail locations are expected to close. Some say this is part of a retail apocalypse. Others just they call it change. Lee Peterson is Executive Vice President of Thought Leadership and Marketing at the Dublin retail consulting firm WD Partners. Welcome to the show.
Hi, my pleasure. Thank you.
Doug Buchanan, Editor-in-Chief at Columbus Business First. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Doug, what do you make of the retail apocalypse description?
Well, I think it's true on the real estate side of things that there is a retail real estate, certainly a shakeup going on. We are seeing a lot of changes in store count and store sizes and store design. But I don't know that I would say it's a, retail industry apocalypse in the sense that, as you pointed out, the people are still spending, like crazy. They're still spending. It's just that consumer habits are changing. A lot of it is going online. So you're seeing more online, you're seeing more investment in distribution, warehouses, that sort of thing, and less in physical stores, especially with malls.
Yeah. What do you think, Lee?
I agree with that. But my position is that I don't think there's any such thing as a retail apocalypse. I think it's a bad retail apocalypse or old retail apocalypse, because there's a lot of new companies that are doing extremely well. First and foremost on everybody's mind would be Amazon. And I don't think a lot of people know this, but Amazon's revenues, simple revenues, have grown over $100 billion in the last 3 years. And retail itself, as a total, has been up 2 to 3% pretty consistently since the Great Recession. So I don't know that it's an apocalypse. It's just a massive, massive disruption.
It seems sort of stealth, too, because I'm not a big shopper. But if I'm out and vacationing and that kind of a thing, like I was recently doing some kind of cheese trail out in the hinterlands, I stopped in Berlin, Ohio. There was a beautiful store there that I ended up buying a couple gifts at. Mm-hmm. And I said, how do you keep afloat, even though it's, there's a tourism thing out there, but still, how do you keep afloat? She says, well, it's online. Most of our stuff we sell online. And so she's got a retail bit where she can have a home and have where her stock is, but she's, between the Etsy and the gift thing, she didn't even blink an eye.
And I think that's part of it. I think that those that adjusted quickly are going to be successful. The issue is if you're very large, we were talking about this before we went on the air, if you're huge, like somebody like Sears, it's difficult to adjust quickly because in reality, it all happened really fast. I mean, I was watching a movie the other night from like 1999 and nobody had cell phones, nobody had anything.
Yeah.
And you're talking about 20 years ago, and if you have a company with thousands of stores, it's really difficult to change.
You know, when you mentioned, we had this whole conversation off air, Doug Buchanan, that, Sears was kind of the first Amazon. We were talking about the big, huge catalogs we lug around.
I mean, they were the ones that
wish
were the big online marketplace where you could get just about everything. And if Sears had the foresight early on to bring all of that online and to think of themselves as an online store with that amount of merchandise and that breadth and that brand and that history, they could have turned themselves into a real powerhouse, and instead they've stuck with the physical side of things, and then they had all kinds of series of unfortunate decisions and mishaps and lack of investment, and Amazon ate their lunch, and Sears ultimately collapsed. And so, echoing something that Lee was saying, it's the apocalypse that we're seeing is amongst the bad retailers. Like the number when you see these stories about hundreds and thousands of stores each year closing. I mean, you're talking about potentially a relatively small number of very large, very prominent places with a lot of stores that go under just because they couldn't survive. Toys R Us was another example of that. Payless stores. I mean, there's a
Payless shoes, right?
Yeah, there's a list of them, and you know it does create disruption. You know, there's no doubt about it. But the smaller, potentially nimbler, certainly the more nimbler retailers are navigating this and you know surviving if not thriving.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the changes in retail. My guest, you just heard Doug Buchanan. He's editor in chief at Columbus Business First, and we also have Lee Peterson. He's executive vice president of Thought Leadership and Marketing at WD Partners. That's a retail consulting firm in Dublin. Yeah, Lee.
And I think another issue is leadership. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're hypothetically, you're 60 years old, you're the CEO of a company, and you're thinking what it's going to take to change this company. Let's say you have a 500 stores, which is not abnormal. What it's going to take to change this company is going to cause a lot of pain. I'm going to have to close a lot of stores. We potentially could not do the same type of volume that we did before. Therefore, our stock price is going to go down.
Yeah.
Well, I'm 60 years old. I'm about to retire. This is not going to happen on my watch. So let's draw this thing out, you know, as much as we possibly can before the imminent change, like a huge disruption, is going to have to happen in order to make a lot of retailers more updated.
And that's a function of, you know, I mean, Sears started out as a family owned. I mean, everything was family owned in the beginning. It did matter if it outlived you because your family was taking it over. But there's not that kind of personal investment anymore.
No, and the other half of that investment equation is Sears was massively financed with debt, and so they had and Toys R Us was the same thing. The people who bought them, the private equity firms, the VC firms that bought them, used a lot of debt to buy these places, and they simply just didn't have the money to make a lot of investments or the kinds of massive investments that you're saying that you would need to like turn a Sears into an Amazon, and so they kept trying the same thing
and cost cutting and
everything else and so it was kind of a double edged sword where not only were they not innovating but they weren't keeping their stores fresh and consumers these days are too savvy for that sort of thing, and it shows.
What, you know, when a Sears goes under or a Macy's or, you know, whatever it was before then, Marshall Fields or any of these kind of anchor stores that we think mm-hmm. of, are those there still are anchor stores out there, but is that template going away, that Northland Mall, City Center kind of a template just going away?
I think what's going away is the tenant mix in particular. We were talking about this before too, but Easton has always had, I feel like, a great tenant mix. So I can go see a movie, I can go get a cup of coffee, I can go have a glass of wine. Oh, by the way, I can buy some jewelry. Some of these stores, you know, you don't Tesla. I can go look at a car. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's more of a lot of things to do than it is just row after row of specialty stores. And I think that those malls, sort of the B and C malls that are nothing but rows and rows of specialty stores, are going to have a really, really difficult time in the next 5 years.
They've done it something similar like to that at the Worthington Mall, this little mall in Worthington that has yoga, a boot camp, restaurants now, lots of restaurants. And they amazingly and wonderfully, in my opinion, put the farmer's market in there over the winter, which was fabulous.
That's funny. We did a study on just last year, and we asked 3,500 people, if you know your mall anchors went away, what would you like to see in its place? And we gave them like 25 choices. And number one was farmer's markets. And it kind of floored me, you know, after that was grocery store, but I think five of the top 10 were food oriented, but modern food oriented. Mm-hmm. But farmer's market ranked number one, especially with people over 45.
Right.
You're also seeing that change if you go up to Polaris, which again started out as more of a traditional mall, and then they lost a couple of their anchors, and they actually tore one of them down and rebuilt to make that section
Easton
of the mall
like.
Easton like. Yeah, right. I mean they were not not shy about saying that. And one of the tenants in there, we were just up there a month or so ago, was a co-working space, you know, in a mall, and it's actually in a former bar restaurant.
But it's bringing in people who are going to shop at the mall. They're going to eat there.
Right. And work there. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and so you've got to bring them in for things other than just simply going to pick up something at Macy's. And you know, that's how you're going to get that foot traffic still going. Tuttle's another example where, remember, they had two Macy's at one point.
Yeah.
It was an odd situation there. But and one of those, they're now turning into this big, like go kart track with laser tag and bowling, and you know, it's just like this completely different kind of an experience than shopping. And again, it's just because you're not going to get another department store to come in there and fill that entire space. So you either have to knock it down, or you got to do something radically different.
That's an interesting thing. I'm thinking about right now IKEA, the golfing place. I can't think of the name.
Top Golf.
There's Cabela's, there's Polaris, there's Costco. It's like this whole weekend getaway for some people. Lots of hotels around there as well. Yeah. And that's a thing.
Easton was the same way when they opened, right off the bat, that enormous Hilton opened not soon after.
Why? Right.
Yeah, that was my reaction.
Well, they're sold out a lot of weekends because people would come from all over Ohio and stay there just to shop.
Right.
Or I guess go to the movies and do 15 other things too.
Yeah, yeah. And Easton, as Lee mentioned, they seem to get the tenant mix right kind of off the bat. And we were just talking to Les Wexner at the 20th anniversary, right. Of this. And he mentioned one of the things he was surprised about were the restaurants that, just how popular and how much of a draw they were. Because remember, most time when you went to a mall, you were going to, food courts. And
I know there's been some change, but it's been pretty steady. Even the restaurant mix there, they've been pretty successful.
Oh, yeah.
At Easton.
Yeah, and they've done a great job of it, like North Star and Jenny's.
And adding and kind of mixing it up and adding when
Shake
it makes
Shack.
Sense.
They just opened a Shake Shack there.
Right. But, again, people were going there to as Lee points, people were going there to eat and then, I can also, do some shopping while I'm there. It wasn't like I don't know what you feel about food courts, but,
No.
These are, you're there because you're hungry. I mean, you're not like, that's
if
not
you're that
destined.
Hungry.
Yeah, exactly.
You shouldn't have gone to the mall.
Yeah. I'm going to hold out a little bit longer here.
I mentioned our study, but we were surprised we had food hall in there. And then specifically said, not a food court, but a food hall, where food trucks would pull in to a big empty department store space or something like that. Yeah. That also ranked extremely high.
When you're talking about the farmers markets and the food hall idea, that's telling me local as well.
Yeah, that's
true. People are kind of conscious of that too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sbarro may be great for a lot of people, but I think most shoppers these days are
and they're moving out of the malls.
Yeah, Sbarro, they are actually.
And they're getting their own places.
Yeah, they are. And I think part of that is the stigma of being a food court, operation that if you're actually out, it's not that dissimilar to the offerings, but if you're out in a strip mall area or separated, then you look like a standard kind of fast casual place instead of a food court. I think the consumers are just they're more savvy to that sort of thing, and they don't want to associate with food courts.
I'm surprised at how many things people are willing to buy online. There's still things, maybe I'm sure it's just a function of I'm older, but there's just things I'm not going to go and buy furniture online, for instance. I'm going to want to go and sit down. But obviously, furniture is exploding online. The mattresses. Casper's shown that.
Yeah.
What do we know about what people are unwilling to buy online?
So far, not much. But so far, the DIY stores, I think, are doing
Michael's,
really well.
Home Joanne Depot, Fabrics. Okay, Home Depot's, yeah. Oh, okay.
Home Depot's doing really well, but they've still been very smart about it. They do a tremendous amount of business with buy online, pick up in store.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like the consumer is acknowledging, like, you know what, your store, your warehouse is not that great. Could you just bring it out in front for me? I need your stuff because I really kind of can't get that anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And so far, I'm still waiting for the day, though, that Bezos decides that he's going to get into that DIY business. But it must be way down on the list for him compared to something like grocery.
Well, it's still a premium to go into those stores and kind of stand in front of the nuts and bolts until somebody comes up and says, can I help you? And they're like, yeah, because I have no idea what to do.
I would say that would be, you know, one example is, and I would even go a step below that and say like the local hardware stores, not even the Lowe's and the Home Depot's. But as a homeowner of many years who has muddled my way through a whole bunch of half-baked projects. I'm going in there and I'm asking somebody, right, like, how do I do this? Yeah. Like, can you just point me, show me, and do it? And you can't get that, you know, online. You can certainly watch some YouTube videos, but I mean, that would be an idea for, like, I would never shop for that kind of thing online because, you know, number one, the toilet's running right now. I can't wait Amazon's 24 hours to get the parts.
Amazon's out there.
Right, exactly.
I made the poor lady at Ace Hardware help me pick out paint the other day, and she kept saying, well, either is nice. And I'm like, yeah, but I know. So anyways, we are going to continue our conversation about the changing retail scenario. Brick and mortar, 7,000 plus brick and mortar stores are set to close this year alone, while online retail sales are growing faster than we can count. So if you have a question or comment, having a personal opinion on this, what do you think? Do you like to shop? What do you like to shop in person for? Apparently, it's very little that needs to be purchased in person. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, too. Make sure you go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Payless Shoe Source filed for bankruptcy and announced it would shutter all of its 2,500 North American stores. Nearly 400 Family Dollar stores will close this year. In all, 7,100 stores of one stripe or another are expected to close in the U.S. in 2019. Meanwhile, online retail is expanding. We're talking about the changing retail picture. Still with us, Lee Peterson. He's Executive Vice President of Thought Leadership and Marketing at the Dublin retail consulting firm WD Partners. Also, Columbus Business First Editor-in-Chief Doug Buchanan. Venki Shankar is Coleman Chair Professor in Marketing and Director of Research at the Center for Retailing Studies at Texas A&M University. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Nice to be on the show.
Thank you. Venki, what do we know about brick-and-mortar retailers that have successfully shifted to online?
That's a great question. As you know, the trend is more towards omni-channel retailing. And what it means is that whether you're a digital native or a brick-and-mortar store first, all the stores are converging into omni-channel. And some of the stores, depending on the category that you're talking about, have made very good transition. Best Buy is a great example in the electronic goods and appliances, durable goods category. Walmart is making significant strides trying to make it omni-channel. Target is already moving fast in that direction. So we've got plenty of good examples, but what is missing here is that how quickly are these people making the transitions? And that is a matter of concern for a lot of brick-and-mortar first retailers, and that's why many of them are going out of business because they're not making the transition fast enough.
How quickly do they have to do it? What's the metric there?
They should have done it yesterday.
Are
unfortunately catching up. And the fundamental change that has happened here is that consumer is ahead of the firms in terms of technology adoptions. You know, the millennials have surpassed all the generations, and they are digital first, and they're always thinking in terms of searching online, doing all the convenience online. And unfortunately, stores are, the retail chains are basically legacy oriented. They're most of their employees and the top management are still grappling with technology issues. So the key metric is how fast are you collecting data about your customers first and then adjusting your stores based on that. And unfortunately, many of the brick-and-mortar stores are not collecting data enough. Data is the new oil. Unfortunately, the stores who have not been collecting data are always the ones that are, you mentioned a lot of store closings and chain closings. Mm-hmm. They are the ones that's suffering because they're not collecting data fast enough.
Why? What do we know about why they're not? You're saying it's just the leadership? Like Lee Peterson brought that up earlier. Just leadership or lack
thereof.
Leadership
is one part of it, but the structure and the culture. If you think about traditionally brick-and-mortar stores that have remained steadfastly brick-and-mortar, even though e-commerce started 25 years ago. It's not like it's just started yesterday, but they never made the transition. So it's also the structure and the culture. They never invest in POS materials, for example. Many of them, they never invested in data. And all of these are very difficult for these firms suddenly overnight. And they used to outsource it to third party. Even Walmart tried to do that, and then they realized quickly they have to change themselves. They can't just depend on a third party anymore. And if you look at the success of Amazon, Amazon has always been the e-commerce arm for a lot of companies, and that's how, Borders.com and Toys R Us, and that's how they surged. And while Amazon was eating their lunch, all these firms were thinking, oh, that's just a small outsourcing decision for us. But now they're confronted with reality, which is really consumers think digital first or online first, and then they think about whether they want to consider or even want to come into a store next. And that has changed the thinking quite a bit.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the changing face of retail. You just heard from Venki Shankar. He's Coleman Chair, Professor in Marketing and Director of Research at the Center for Retailing Studies at Texas A&M. Lee Peterson.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And one of the misnomers to me that's out there is it's not technology that's disrupting retail. It's the customer. The customer is disrupting retail. And one of the things about Amazon is that they've always understood that. Their mission statement is to be the most customer-centric company in the world. So in other words, if you back up from that, what they're saying is we're always going to be the disruptor. If the customer is the disruptor and they're always on doing what the customer wants, they're going to always disrupt, which I think is so much different than traditional thinking in retail.
Let's go to traditional. Elaine in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, Ann.
You own a small retail shop in Central Ohio?
Yes, actually, I own a small store in Worthington, Ohio, and I just wanted to call in and talk a little bit about I hear a lot of people on your show talking about the sort of macro Amazons and the Best Buys and how you have to, get online. There's also a really big trend in sort of micro retailing, which is what I would put myself in, that category. It's boutique-y, but it's community-oriented, and I find a lot of support from the community, people coming in to shop, and to come in to actually look at the merchandise, feel it, touch it, and, see what it's about. And since much of it is actually handmade, they are very excited to learn that people are actually doing things and making things that are for sale on shelves that they can actually purchase.
I buy gifts almost exclusively in person, unless it's a wedding, I go to places just like Elaine's. Almost exclusively for those kind of a thing. What do we know, Venki Shankar, about the role and how this local boutique retail fits into the new scenario?
Absolutely. They have a big role to play. As Elaine has testified, that there is always space for this niche retailers, and that would continue to be the case because people, as more and more people, more and more retailers become undifferentiated, having omni-channel presence everywhere, there's always customers who want some differentiation. They want to touch and feel. They want to be felt special in some stores where they're really exclusively catered to. Sometimes that special touches will help a lot. But unfortunately, that those would be very niche and smaller players, but they will be very strong and successful. However, the majority of growth is going to come from omni-channel retailers.
I think what we're calling, what Elaine's talking about, is the third wave of retail. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first wave was ma and pa stores, and the second wave was chain stores with malls proliferating. And now there's because of the online onslaught, there's a lot of retailers. You could call it sort of the Brooklynization of retail, where, yeah, you can buy just about anything you want, but every once in a while you want to go touch things, as she alluded to. And so this third wave, I think, is going to be quite successful. A lot of times when I think about it, I think about the restaurants in that case, like the North Star group here. And they've got Brassica, and they've got North Star, and they have five or six restaurants, but they're not thinking about 1,000 restaurants. They're thinking about 6, 7, 8 restaurants, and they're good, which is a lot different mentality than it was, say, 30, 40 years ago.
And they have a story to tell behind that as well, the locally sourced product, the locally sourced ingredients, the emphasis on healthy that they literally cannot scale it that much. And I'm sure Elaine is in the same boat, to where, as she mentioned, there's a story behind the merchandise that mm-hmm. she's selling that people are connecting with, but you're just not going to be able to scale that very well, nor, it sounds like, does she want to.
Mm-hmm. And Venky Shankar, I'm wondering if there's going to be another wave 25, 30 years down the road, when sort of the carbon footprint of these Amazon-esque business model is going to be stymied.
Absolutely. Sustainability is becoming a very important consideration in the growth of retailing and stores. Stores, brick-and-mortar stores, are becoming so conscious about not just carbon footprint, but ways of recycling, ways of reducing supply chain costs. And you mentioned Amazon, just the size of the warehouses and other things being a threat. But let's take packaging, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long can we sustain these packaging where there's excessive waste of packaging materials and repurposing the cart? Now that's going to become a very big issue 10, 15 years from now, because the retailers, the online retailers, the omnichannel retailers who are shipping a lot have to be very concerned about how efficiently they do this shipping. And there may come to a stage in which the consumers, like Lee mentioned, of our customers are driving, are disrupting. The customers are going to become very conscious and say, hey, I'm not going to be responsible for the environment being degraded like this by ordering thousands and millions of boxes and packing materials. But I'm going to be taking charge, and I'm going to be very selective about how I order and how I visit stores. That's when I think the dynamics will change. Plus, don't forget the AI revolution that's going to overtake, too. A lot of jobs will be replaced, displaced. A lot of things will be deliveries will be automated. Those things will shake up considerably. Today's reports from Oxford Economics says 20 million jobs will be displaced by 2030. And how is that going to shape up in the face of carbon footprint and sustainability? That's going to be a big picture coming down the road.
And everybody's going to open a restaurant.
So the retail operators that didn't see the internet coming have flailed. Many have failed. Is it going to be that the omni operators that don't see the sustainability revolution coming are going to fail as well? Then, Venky.
I can't say whether some will fail for sure. There'll always be a shakeout. But those who don't prepare themselves for diminished use of this or more efficient use of this, they're going to be in trouble. I mean, I mean, you can't endlessly supply things overnight and or the same day delivery, because now you'll have to be more cautious about the environment more so than that. And so it really requires planning down the road and what programs you have in place. And only the retailers who take this into account will be successful in the long run.
Okay, is that what retailers need to be? What about getting people to come into a store now? We've been talking about the niche, but is the niche, is that gift store, that gift shop, the same gift shop it was 25 years ago? What are they doing differently?
Yeah, they are. The whole format of retail is changing. For example, the malls are being replaced. The big malls, big stores are being replaced by smaller format shopping. The biggest thing that online and digital has done is they've done away with the need for stock keeping. That you don't have to keep endless inventory of items in big stores. And because not, a lot of them could be virtual and could be ordered if you just know your preference. So all you need to do is stock the right things at the right time and sample. So many of these gift shops and boutiques and other things, they are specialty items. So they have to really be very, very nimble, and they have to be very catering to specific needs. And again, I go back to data. Now, you know, 10, 15 years from now, every retailer that's going to be successful is going to know a lot about their customers, what they like, what they don't like, and then behavioral analysis of what they will be needing for the future. So every store has to be very custom, and customers themselves want customized experiences. They're not going to be impressed when they walk into the store and then find this varieties because they already seen it virtually. And so the IoT, Internet of Things, augmented reality, AR, virtual reality, VR, all of these are possible with a handheld device, whether it's a watch, or a smartphone, or whatever it is. People are already able to look into all these things and go plan ahead of time. Which gift shop I want to be in, how, when, or how long can they deliver to me? All of these things will be planned in advance. And that's how these things are going to move. And even the specialty stores will have their own customer profile, and they have to be very, very conscious of protecting them and then catering to their needs.
I think there's something else really interesting. We've been talking about this a lot lately. That's going on. That a consumer now, and everybody in this room, and everybody out there has one of these what we call anything engines. I'm looking at three of them here on a table here. Where with this device, I can get anything anytime I want. I can watch sports. I can, you know, I can look up a medical thing. I can do anything I want.
I can
find out
anything.
Where to go somewhere. And so the mentality, a consumer mentality, has changed considerably in terms of expectations. They sort of expect anything. And so now you're starting to see brands really branch out. And this is a bad example, but the Taco Bell just announced that we're going to do a hotel. Restoration Hardware has a fabulous restaurant, and they're going to do a hotel. And, you know,
the Brew Dog.
Brew Dog.
And I see that. So if you, we used to say a brand has to have permission to do these other things, but it doesn't seem like that anymore. I think our mentality is I can get anything I want anytime I want. Why can't my favorite brand give me this, this, and this, and this? Because I really like them. So if they gave me, you know, a certain bottle of water and it was that brand, I would buy that. So I think you're going to see kind of a stretching out because of that mentality of retail, of the best brands. So Apple, I just found out the other day, Apple sells bike helmets and jump ropes and things for your tennis rackets. So they're starting that shift as well.
Venky Shankar, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
That's Venky Shankar. He's director of research. He's and at the Center for Retailing Studies at Texas A&M University. We're going to continue our conversation. We'd like to hear from you. Are you a retailer out there? Tell us your experience in the changing climate for retail. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 7,000 stores are projected to close across the country this year. We're talking about the changing script for retail. Still with us is Lee Peterson. He's Executive Vice President of Thought, Leadership, and Marketing at WD Partners. That's a retail consulting firm in Dublin. And also Doug Buchanan. He's Editor-in-Chief at Columbus Business First. If you have a question or a comment, want to weigh in on this topic, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to bring up something, Doug Buchanan, that you mentioned at the very beginning, and that's the real estate.
Sure.
You know, what's happening to these footprints? Now, you know, obviously they just tore down City Center, which is amazing when you think that within the span of a little less than 30 years.
Northland.
In Northland. Yeah. But they literally tore down and they did the same thing in Northland. Yeah. They tore it down or they tore down most of it and they've replaced it with something else. They've rethought the real estate. But that's creating a lot of opportunity, is it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you can find another good, you know, use for that land, the problem is that we're already over real estated. You know, we've got too much
overdeveloped.
There's too much square footage, too much capacity out there already. Because even the healthy stores are still closing their unprofitable locations and shrinking the size of the stores that they have. You know, they're all, as leases come up, that's just the
Target in the short or in the university district.
Well, yeah, that's a good example.
Abercrombie did too.
And Abercrombie and Fitch has been doing this a lot. And, and even some of their big flagship stores that they put out there abroad and in, you know, New York City, they're bringing those down. But even just in regular malls, if they can, when the lease comes up, if they can get it into a smaller footprint, they're doing that. It is creating opportunities. But I think, as we discussed earlier, you're probably not going to see all of these spaces taken up by other traditional brick and mortar retailers. It's real estate that is almost always having to be repurposed.
But it is green. It is in a brownfield. So there's that. I mean, and usually they're surrounded by things as well.
Yeah, but the examples that you brought up, Columbus City Center is now a park. It's just green space.
Right.
Northland ended up being like city offices and some and
county
some
offices, county I offices. Think.
Yeah, and, county offices. Yeah. And Westland is just sitting there.
Part casino.
Yeah, yeah. It should have been. You know what's interesting when I think about Northland is the whole Morse Road corridor and how that is flourishing now in its way because of international, because of the immigrants and what they brought to the scenario.
There's a lot of fascinating retail going on
along
that corridor there that you would just, if you haven't been through there, you would never even know it existed or you would have never imagined it. You talk about a thriving entrepreneurial scene as far as specialized, targeted retail. The people there are parts of they're part of the immigrant and refugee community, and they're targeting their community. And there's just a lot of interesting stores up there.
The big international grocery store over there on Morse.
Saraga.
Yeah. They're opening a new, or they've opened another one.
Yep.
So there's obviously a demand for that, and people are loving it. We have an email from Tyler in Steubenville. He says, as a young person, 24, that's been back and forth between the Ohio Valley and Columbus for the last several years, the difference I see in malls that are successful versus those that aren't so much is that chain anchors don't sell it. Macy's and JCPenney don't seem to bother catering to young people's taste or budget. While Easton and Polaris have a couple of those classical anchors, they keep them on the fringes. Easton has new lab spaces in the main concourse that allow smaller startups to test the waters. And in one of the parking garages, there's an embroidery shop. I think that's interesting because sometimes when I go into Macy's, they've got like disc jockeys in there playing super loud music. And I wonder, what in the world are they thinking? There's nobody there, and I walk out because it's just ridiculous. Yeah. It's too loud. I mean, but they're trying. Is that thought to be a way to attract people?
Well, I think he brings up something interesting, and especially about Easton, because Easton has always been about sort of the local merchants and a de-emphasis of the huge department stores. They're kind of back a little bit, like Macy's is back a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Nordstrom's all the way down at one end, and Nordstrom itself is pretty much an anomaly, you know, for the area. But at the same time, we've always had Homage there and, like we said before, North Star and smaller companies like that, which I think make that mix really interesting and kind of a place that you want to go versus a place that you have to go.
And they both, as he mentioned, have been adding these pop-up spaces where non-traditional retailers or retailers that want to try new things mm-hmm. can quickly go in, see if it works, and then quickly get out again. And not only is that good for the retailers, but it does make it interesting for the shoppers to go there, because you just never know what you're going to see.
Has that been around, though, for a long time with the kiosks in the malls, that kind of a thing, or not so much? You know what I mean?
It feels a little different.
Yeah, okay. I think kiosks feel more like food court type things.
Yeah, okay.
And this is more like a food truck.
Yeah. Like street hawkers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, just don't look them in the eye. Just keep walking down. What about the downtown experience of retail? People continue to complain that although, it's unbelievable, the growth in residential housing in downtown Columbus, that the grocery stores haven't followed. And I think that there's a Hills Market down there. There's a Kroger down by the Brewery District. They're coming in, and they're getting better. But what about that? I mean, what do you see downtown Columbus creating that kind of a retail magnet?
I think what you're seeing first, like kind of the pioneers so far, have been the restaurants like Wolfridge. And Pins and a few other places that are drawing customers back to downtown. It's more difficult now because we're not in an apparel cycle. I think used apparel is peaking, so people are going to Salvation Army to buy their clothes. So I'm not going to open an apparel store probably first, or take that chance versus someplace like the Short North. But I think you're starting to see the turnover, with the restaurants being kind of the tip of the spear.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's as Lee mentioned, it's consumers that are instigating a lot of these changes, and if consumers will be more willing to get used to the parking situation downtown and be more willing to shop at smaller grocery stores and the retailers that you will see more of that happen, because there is a good number of retail stores up and down the Short North, for example, mm-hmm. And obviously all the restaurants.
The galleries
are all moving to Franklinton at this point. So you do have obviously a good number of people who are willing to do that. But if you're talking about like all around downtown, I think you got to have the rooftop. You got to get the residential concentration down there first, and then you'll potentially see more of the retailers follow.
Facebook message from Stu asks, why isn't transit better incorporated into both getting to places like Easton and creating better connections within these venues, like using historic trolleys, rental bikes with cargo baskets, and walking services that aren't so hard on your feet? Easton whiffed in transit, forcing its CODA stop across Morse Road, forcing riders to make a long and risky walk. It is a downside for Easton, is just getting out there. The idea is you get out there and then you stay, because you can eat, you can stay overnight if you must, and you can find something to clothe yourself with. But what about the whole transit picture? That kind of gets into that sustainability question we talked about a little bit earlier.
I think it's a difficult situation in Columbus. We've proposed and put up to the people, like the rails. The high street rail a couple of different times.
The fixed rails
failed. Yeah. We've never got the funding to do it. A classic example, and I think there has to be kind of more of a public belief, again, coming from the consumer. Mm-hmm. A classic example is we put a bike rack, the transit bikes in front of a store in Upper Arlington, and the guy put a big sign out in front, like, how would you like this in front of your house? And I thought, he must not understand retail completely, because if you had people coming and picking up bikes and dropping off bikes right in front of your store,
that'd be a good thing.
Well, that's that fix, and that's what shocked me about the streetcar question, is how little people understood the idea that if you get off at the streetcar at the same place every day, well, you can get your coffee at the same place, or you could stop and get your hair done at the same place, or whatever. I mean, it's studied.
I mean, as it points out, I mean, the consumers are leading this because it's not like there's not take the bikes. You know, how many Kogo, Lime, you know, all these different bike providers did we have over there? And then we now and continuing, we're experimenting with scooters. Mm-hmm. The Smart Columbus people are experimenting with that shuttleless or that driverless shuttle that's going around there, because that's eventually
along the Scioto Mile.
Yeah, along the Scioto Mile, and that's eventually targeted to get people to and around Easton. Like they've specifically said that that's one of the target areas that they are thinking of it, you know, at some point. So, but you know, until consumers get comfortable with that, and until you see widespread adoption of it, you're still going to be dependent on cars and walking everywhere when you go there. Because you know, I don't see East End springing for a rail system or for more buses to go through their shopping district.
Yeah, we're still an automobile culture for the most part. With pockets, obviously, like New York City or Boston or, you know, San Francisco and places like that where people have moved back into the city to really make it happen. But I think to your point, you know, the more people we get downtown, the more that'll happen or the more demand there will be for it.
Mm-hmm.
Things like grocery stores adapting to the changes in retail, that's a big issue. We have everything from the meals,
yeah,
the meal ingredients that are shipped to your door. You talk about waste. To going and picking up your groceries to the likes of Walmart, which are thinking about bringing it right to your door.
Right. Well, we've talked a lot today about the investment that these successful retailers are putting into these innovations, and I think that you're seeing the Krogers, the Giant Eagles, certainly the Walmarts and the Targets investing in technology to try to meet the consumers where they are, and that is the curbside pickups, home deliveries, different ways to check out when you're actually in the store. I mean, they are innovating. They are trying new things because, as Lee pointed out, the everything machine, would you call this?
The anything engine.
Yeah. because it's something like a grocery store. I think people are transitioning and getting a lot more comfortable with, setting up their list and buying there. And I think you pointed out, they want to sit on their couch and buy everything and then just, okay, fine, I'll drive there, but I don't want to go in. I want you to, bring it out to me.
What have we become?
Was that Wally or whatever?
We've become in charge, I think is what we've become.
As far as the consumers go.
Yeah. Just us personally, I'll never forget that. I've got a computer, I think my first computer in 1997. And for a holiday, I bought a lot of Christmas presents online. And I remember thinking, I'm never going to a shopping center again on holiday.
Wait, what do I do for a living?
I got to park. Exactly. I have to park in the snow. I have to go into the store. You know, they've got extra employees out there. I'm going to sit right here and buy my kids all the presents they need.
We only have about a minute left, but we talked about the disruption, yeah, and the job loss that this creates. Is this are there better jobs out there for the thousands of people that are losing jobs this year because of the closures? Is there a shift?
I think what's not being talked about is the new jobs that are going to be created. Walmart could become 3/4 of a fulfillment center. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to do with that. And then, like, how do you get the goods to somebody's house? These are mm-hmm. all brand new jobs. I think it's more about changing. Now, whether or not it'll be the same income is the real question.
Or the same convenience, because now instead of a retail job, you have a distribution job and you're down at Rickenbacker instead of at the grocery store by your house.
Yeah, and a totally different person.
Yeah,
too.
True.
Well, food for thought for another conversation. Doug Buchanan, Editor-in-Chief at Columbus Business First, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks
I really
for having
appreciate
me,
it.
Yeah.
And Lee Peterson, Executive Vice President of Thought Leadership and Marketing at WD Partners in Dublin, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.